Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is part two of another view of the civil rights movement, which was actually authored by the chief of police of Montgomery, Alabama, during the civil rights movement. And we will begin today with The Beast as Saint, the truth about Martin Luther King. When the communists took over a country, one of the first things they did was to confiscate all the privately held weapons to deny the people the physical ability to resist tyranny. But even more insidious than the theft of the people's weapons was the theft of their history. Official communist historians rewrote history to fit the current party line. In many countries, revered national heroes were excised from the history books, or their real deeds were distorted to fit communist ideology. And communist killers and criminals were converted into official saints. Holidays were declared in honour of the beasts that murdered countless nations. Did you know that much the same process has occurred right here in America? Every January, the media go into a kind of almost spastic frenzy of adulation for the so-called Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King has even had a national holiday declared in his honour. An honour accorded to no other American, not Washington, not Jefferson, not Lincoln. Washington and Lincoln no longer even have holidays. They share the generic-sounding President's Day. A liberal judge has sealed the FBI files on King until the year 2027. What are they hiding? Let's take a look at this modern-day plastic god. Born in 1929, King was the son of a black preacher, known at the time only as Daddy King. Daddy King named his son Michael. In 1935, Daddy King had an inspiration to name himself after the Protestant reformer Martin Luther. He declared to his congregation that henceforth they were to refer to him as Martin Luther King and to his son as Martin Luther King Jr. None of this name-changing was ever legalized in court. Daddy King's son's real name to this day is Michael King. We read in Michael Hoffman's Holiday for a Cheetah, quote, "The first public sermon that King ever gave in 1947 at the Ebenezer Baptist Church was plagiarized from a homily by Protestant clergyman Harry Emerson Fosdick, entitled Life is What You Make It. According to the testimony of King's best friend of that time, Reverend Larry H. Williams. The first book that King wrote, Stride Towards Freedom, was plagiarized from numerous sources, all unattributed, according to documentation recently assembled by sympathetic King scholars Keith D. Miller, Ira G. Zepp Jr., and David J. Garrow. And no less an authoritative source than the four senior editors of The Papers of Martin Luther King Jr., an official publication of the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change Incorporated, whose staff includes King's widow Coretta, stated of King's writings at both Boston University and Crozer Theological Seminary, judged retroactively by the standards of academic scholarship, his writings are tragically flawed by numerous instances of plagiarism. Appropriated passages are particularly evident in his writings in his major field of graduated study, systematic theology. King's essay, The Place of Reason and Experience in Finding God, written at Crozer, pirated passages from the work of theologian Edgar S. Brightman, author of The Finding of God, another of King's theses, Contemporary Continental Theology, written shortly after he entered Boston University. It was largely stolen from a book by Walter Marshall Horton. King's doctoral dissertation, A Comparison of the Conceptions of God in the Thinking of Paul Tillich and Harry Nelson Veman, for which he was awarded a PhD in theology, contains more than 50 complete sentences, plagiarized from the PhD dissertation of Dr. Jack Boozer, The Place of Reason in Paul Tillich's Concept of God. According to the Martin Luther King Papers, in King's dissertation, only 49% of sentences in the section on Tillich contain five or more words that were King's own. Close quote. In the Journal of American History, June 1991, page 87, David J. Garrow, a leftist academic who is sympathetic to King, says that King's wife, Coretta Scott King, who also served as his secretary, was an accomplice in his repeated cheating. Reading Garrow's article, one is led to the inescapable conclusion that King cheated because he had chosen for himself a political role in which a PhD would be useful, and lacking the intellectual ability to obtain the title fairly, went after it by any means necessary. Why then, one might ask, did the professors at Crozer Theological Seminary and Boston University grant him passing grades and a PhD? Garrow states on page 89, King's academic compositions, especially at Boston University, were almost without exception little more than summary descriptions and comparisons of others' writings. Nonetheless, the papers almost always received desirable letter grades, strongly suggesting that King's professors did not expect more. The editors of the Martin Luther King Jr. papers state, quote, "The failure of King's teachers to notice his pattern of textual appropriation is somewhat remarkable." Close quote. But researcher Michael Hoffman tells us, quote, "Actually, the malfeasance of the professors is not at all remarkable. King was politically correct. He was black, and he had ambitions. The left professors were happy to award a doctorate to such a candidate, no matter how much fraud was involved. Nor is it any wonder that it has taken 40 years for the truth about King's record of nearly constant intellectual piracy to be made public." Close quote. Supposed scholars who, in reality, shared King's vision of a racially mixed and Marxist America purposely covered up his cheating for decades. The cover-up still continues. From the New York Times of October 11, 1991, page 15, we learn that on October 10th of that year, a committee of researchers at Boston University admitted that there is no question but that Dr. King plagiarized in the dissertation. However, despite its finding, the committee said, "No thought should be given to the revocation of Dr. King's doctoral degree," an action the panel said would serve no purpose. No purpose, indeed. Justice demands that, in light of his willful fraud as a student, the titles Reverend and the Doctor should be removed from King's name. Well, friends, he is not a legitimate reverend, he is not a bona fide PhD, and his name is not really Martin Luther King Jr., so what is left? Just a sexual degenerate, an American-hating communist, and a criminal betrayer of even the interests of his own people. On Labor Day 1957, a special meeting was attended by Martin Luther King and four others at a strange institution called the Highlander Folk School in Monteagle, Tennessee. The school was a communist front, having been founded by Miles Horton, the Communist Party organizer for Tennessee, and Don West, the Communist Party organizer for North Carolina. The leaders of this meeting, with King, were the aforementioned Horton and West, along with Abner Berry and James Dombrowski, all open and acknowledged members of the Communist Party USA. The agenda of the meeting was planning to tour the southern states to initiate demonstrations and riots. From 55 to 60, Martin Luther King's associate advisor and personal secretary was Bayard Rustin. In 36, Rustin joined the Young Communist League at New York City College. Convicted of draft dodging, he went to prison for 2 years in 1944. On January 23, 1953, the Los Angeles Times reported his conviction and sentencing to jail for 60 days for lewd vagrancy and homosexual perversion. Rustin attended the 16th convention of the Communist Party, USA, in February 57, and 1 month later, he and King founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC for short. The president of the SCLC was Dr. Martin Luther King, and the vice president was the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was also the president of an identified communist front known as the Southern Conference Educational Fund, an organization whose field director, Mr. Carl Braden, was simultaneously a national sponsor of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. The program director of the SCLC was the Reverend Andrew Young, in more recent years, Jimmy Carter's ambassador to the UN and mayor of Atlanta. Young, by the way, was trained at the Highlander Folk School previously mentioned. Soon after returning from a trip to Moscow in 1958, Rustin organized the first of King's famous marches on Washington. The official organ of the Communist Party, The Worker, openly declared the march to be a communist project. Although he left King's employ as secretary in 1961, Rustin was called upon King to be second in command of the much larger march on Washington, which took place August 28, 1964. Bayard Rustin's replacement in 61 as secretary and advisor to King was Jack O'Dell, also known as Hunter Pitts O'Dell. According to official records in 1962, Jack O'Dell was a member of the National Committee of the Communist Party USA. He had been listed as a Communist Party member as early as 1956. O'Dell was also given the job of acting executive director for SCLC activities for the entire Southeast. According to the St. Louis Globe Democrat of October 26, 1962, at that time there were still some patriots in the press corps, and word of O'Dell's party membership became known. What did King do? Shortly after the negative news reports, King fired O'Dell with much fanfare, and he then, without the fanfare, immediately rehired him as director of the New York office of the SCLC, as confirmed by the Richmond Newsleader of September 27, 1963. In 1963, a black man from Monroe, North Carolina, named Robert Williams, made a trip to Peking, China, exactly 20 days before King's 1964 march on Washington. Williams successfully urged Mao Zedong to speak on behalf of King's movement. Mr. Williams was also around this time maintaining his primary residence in Cuba, from which he made regular broadcasts to the southern United States three times a week from high-powered AM transmitters in Havana, under the title Radio Free Dixie. In these broadcasts, he urged violent attacks by blacks against white Americans. During this period, Williams wrote a book entitled Negroes with Guns. The writer of the foreword for this book? None other than Martin Luther King Jr. It is also interesting to note that the editors and publishers of this book were all supporters of the infamous Fair Play for Cuba Committee. According to King's biographer and sympathizer David J. Garrow, King privately described himself as a Marxist. In his 1981 book, The FBI and Martin Luther King Jr., Garrow quotes King as saying in SCLC staff meetings, "We have moved into a new era which must be an era of revolution. The whole structure of American life must be changed. We are engaged in the class struggle." Jewish communist Stanley Levison can be described as King's behind-the-scenes handler. Levison, who had for years been in charge of the secret funneling of Soviet funds to the Communist Party, was King's mentor and was actually the brains behind many of King's more successful ploys. It was Levison who edited King's book, Stride Towards Freedom. It was Levison who really controlled the fundraising and agitation activities of the SCLC. Levison wrote many of King's speeches. King described Levison as one of his closest friends. The Federal Bureau of Investigation had for many years been aware of Stanley Levison's communist activities. It was Levison's close association with King that brought about the initial FBI interest in King. Lest you be tempted to believe the controlled media's lie about racists in the FBI being out to get King, you should be aware that the man most responsible for the FBI's probe of King was Assistant Director William C. Sullivan. Sullivan describes himself as a liberal and said initially he was 100% for King because I saw him as an effective and badly needed leader for the black people in their desire for civil rights. The probe of King not only confirmed their suspicions about King's communist beliefs and associations, but it also revealed King to be a despicable hypocrite, an immoral degenerate, and a worthless charlatan. According to Assistant Director Sullivan, who had direct access to the surveillance files on King, which are denied the American people, King may have misapplied substantial amounts of money contributed to the civil rights movement. He may have used SCLC funds to pay for the parties, liquor, and other activities he had at his hotel rooms. In fact, an outfit called the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, which is putting on display the two bedrooms from the Lorraine Motel where King stayed the night before he was shot, has declined to depict in any way the occupants of those rooms. That, according to exhibit designer Gerard Eisterhold, would be close to blasphemy. It would have exposed King's party. Sullivan also stated that King had alienated the affections of numerous married women. According to Sullivan, who in 30 years with the Bureau had seen everything there was to be seen of the seamy side of life, King was one of only 7 people he had encountered who was a total degenerate. Noting the violence that almost invariably attended King's supposedly non-violent marches, Sullivan's probe revealed a very different King from the carefully crafted public image. King welcomed members of many different black groups as members of his SCLC, many of them advocates and practitioners of violence. King's only admonition on the subject was that they should embrace tactical non-violence. Sullivan also relates an incident in which King met in a financial conference with Communist Party representatives, not knowing that one of the participants was an infiltrator, actually working for the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover personally saw to it that documented information on King's communist connections was provided to the President and to Congress, and conclusive information from FBI files was also provided to major newspapers and newswire services. But were the American people informed of King's real nature? No. For even in the 1960s, the fix was in. Controlled media and the bought politicians were bound and determined to push their racial mixing program on America. King was their man, and nothing was going to get in their way. With a few minor exceptions, these facts have been kept from the American people. The pro-King propaganda machine grinds on, and it is even reported that a serious proposal has been made to add some of King's writings as a new book in the Bible. I want you to consider this. What are the forces and motivation behind the controlled media's active promotion of King? What does it tell you about our politicians when you see them, almost without exception, falling all over themselves to honour King as a national hero? What does it tell you about our society when any public criticism of this moral leper and communist functionary is considered grounds for dismissal? What does it tell you about the controlled media when you see how they have successfully suppressed the truth and held out a picture of King that can only be described as a colossal lie? You need to think, my fellow Americans. You desperately need to wake up. Why do we celebrate the King holiday? The life story of Martin Luther King Jr. is disgraceful from the beginning to the end. He openly incited riots, burnings, lootings, and violence that caused several deaths. He used the big lie technique, stating he was for non-violence, but violence followed him everywhere he went. On January 31, 1977, Coretta Scott King obtained a federal court order sealing for 50 years 845 pages of FBI records about her husband because its release would destroy his reputation. Under the order of U.S. Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, the FBI wired King's offices and hotel rooms from 1963 to 1968. These tapes notably document records of his transactions with communist agents and wild parties with women. King portrayed U.S. troops in Vietnam as foreign conquerors and oppressors, and he specifically compared the United States to Nazi Germany. He spoke of Ho Chi Minh, the communist dictator of North Vietnam, as a national leader and the innocent victim of American aggression. Congress had all of this information about King being a womanizer, a traitor to his country, a liar, a cheater, and of inciting riots all over the United States, as well as his association with the Communist Party. The spineless Congress passed a bill approving the observation of the King holiday. This holiday needs to be repealed. Justice denied. The Willie Edwards story. On January 22, 1957, Willie Edwards, Jr. received a telephone call at his home from a Winn-Dixie dispatcher that they needed him to come to work. Willie and his family had just sat down to eat. He did not know his life was in danger. When Willie did not come home the next morning, his wife, Sarah Jean Edwards, called the Montgomery police to report her husband missing. She was told by the officer, "We will get back in touch with you if we find anything." A missing persons report was put out on the police radio. Detective Earl Sellers, my wife's stepfather, was working on the case and made every effort to find Mr. Edwards. The Winn-Dixie truck Willie drove was found abandoned close to the Alabama River. The police scoured the city and looked up and down the creeks and woods near where the truck was found, but were unable to find Willie. Willie Edwards Jr.'s body was found in the water in Lowndes County about 18 years later. After 19 years, Willie's case went to court. The judge ruled that Attorney General Bill Baxley could not prove the cause of death. Baxley built his case against Henry Alexander, William Sonny Livingston, and James D. York upon Raymond Britt's testimony that placed these men on Tyler Goodwin Bridge. Britt stated these men forced Willie to jump from that bridge. When Britt was given a lie detector test, he failed it. Baxley was depending on Britt's testimony, and when he failed the lie detector test, he had no case. Sonny Livingston took the lie detector test, and it showed he had no part in the death of Willie. Bill Baxley made a gallant effort to bring the people responsible for Willie's death to justice. Baxley had given Raymond Britt immunity from prosecution for this testimony, so this let Britt off the hook. It is a real shame that the people responsible for this terrible death were never brought to justice. Rosa Parks, Arrest, by Leroy A. Pierce. On December 1, 1955, I was employed by the Montgomery Police Department and assigned to the Traffic Division. My working territory was Districts 1 to 3, which was the downtown and east side of town, an area I patrolled on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. During the afternoon on this same date, I heard on the police radio a patrol car receive a call to the second block of Montgomery Street. The call was to assist a City Line bus driver that was having a problem with a passenger on his bus. The patrol car that received the call was close to the city lot when they received the call, and I knew that was approximately half a mile away from the second block of Montgomery Street. I was only 4 or 5 blocks from the location of the bus, so as most any police officer would do, I went to the second block of Montgomery Street to see if I could help or prevent any violence from taking place, since the patrol car was so far away. On arriving at the scene of the city bus on Montgomery Street, I parked my motorcycle next to the curb, and I saw the bus driver standing outside his bus at the front door. I asked him what was the problem, and he stated that there was a black female on the bus sitting in the white section. He had asked her to move to the back of the bus, and she had refused. I did not see any disturbance going on inside the bus, so I told the bus driver that I did not receive the call and that a patrol car would be here in a few minutes. When the patrol car arrived on the scene, the two patrol officers exited their car and came over to where the bus driver and I were standing. I told them where I was when the call came in over the radio, and I'd come by to see if I could help in any way. The bus driver told the patrol officer the same thing that he had told me earlier, about the black female refusing to move. At that time, we all entered the bus, and the driver pointed out the black female that had refused to move. One of the patrol officers told the black female that she was in violation of a city ordinance, and that if she did not move, she would be arrested. After being advised by the officer of this violation, the black female still refused to move. At this time, the patrol officer told her that she was under arrest and that she would be taken to the city jail. We took the black female by her arm and escorted her off the bus and into the rear seat of the patrol car. At the time of the arrest, we did not know the name of the arrested person. She did not give us any trouble during the arrest. Bus Segregation, The Untold Story. Most people have never heard of Claudette Colvin or Mary Louise Smith, but they are the ones who paved the way for Rosa Parks. In October 1995, a huge crowd watched as Rosa Parks, mother of the bus boycott in Montgomery, climbed to the podium near the Capitol in Washington, D.C. to address the Million Man March. Parks was hailed once again for the simple, well-remembered act that moved a people to action 40 years ago, December 1, 1955, for refusing to give her bus seat to a white passenger. Claudette Colvin and Mary Louise Smith were not at the march that day, but these two women had a lot to do with why Parks was there. On March 2, 1955, Claudette Colvin was arrested for refusing to give up her seat to a white person on a City Line bus. On October 21st, 1955, Mary Louise Smith was arrested for the same offence. Why did Park's arrest spark a boycott and the Colvin and Smith arrests did not? It is a story of disharmony in the black community. Why Colvin and Smith haven't been recognised in the years since is a historical bum rap that has hung over both women. Colvin and Smith were the first to stand up and be counted as contesting bus segregation. Colvin and Smith are the unrecognised heroes of the Montgomery bus boycott. It is a shame they did not get recognition for their roles in this important event. To understand why most people have never heard of Colvin and Smith, it is important to understand the black community. Members of the small black middle class, ministers, airbase workers, teachers and others in this class, associated mostly with each other. Many of the rest, including Colvin and Smith, were poorer and more isolated. It was a really divided black society. They were discriminating against their own. Could it be that Rosa Parks, the secretary for the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP, was deliberately chosen to be the hero of the Montgomery bus boycott? And I think we'll leave it there for today, and we will continue tomorrow with the bus boycott.